Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. News.
Coronavirus cases continue to rise, straining the capacity of hospitals' intensive care units. Shops and malls could reopen on Monday under strict anti-COVID measures. And the philosopher, Charter 77 signatory and educator Jan Sokol has died at the age of 84. On Monday, 8,745 new coronavirus cases were reported. That's almost 1,000 more than on the same day last week. The number of hospital patients has risen by about 200 since Sunday, according to the Ministry of Health, which says that the situation remains serious. Many hospitals have reached the limit of their capacity to treat patients in intensive care units. Meanwhile, the Industry and Trade Minister, Karol Havlíček, says he will propose to the Cabinet that shops and shopping centers in the Czech Republic be allowed to reopen under strict conditions as of next Monday, February the 22nd. He made the comment after talks with regional governors who were calling for a new state of emergency. The Czech government will propose increasing this year's budget deficit to 500 billion crowns, Finance Minister Alena Schillerová announced. Thus far, a deficit of 320 billion crowns has been approved. MPs are due to negotiate the draft on Thursday. Ms. Schillerová has asked that it be passed within the fast-track procedure. The proposal includes changes stemming from new tax regulations that came into force in January, such as the abolition of the so-called super gross wage. The philosopher, educator, and former politician Jan Sokol has died at the age of 84. After the Velvet Revolution, the Charter 77 signatory served as an MP and as a Minister of Education. He also helped establish the Faculty of Humanities at Charles University and ran for President of the Czech Republic. In the later years of his life, Mr. Sokol was a prolific contributor to the Czech language version of Wikipedia, where he added his expertise to entries on a range of topics. Prime Minister Andrej Babiš last week nominated former Minister of Health Adam Wojciech to be the next Czech ambassador to Finland. It is therefore expected that President Miloš Zeman will support the proposal. Minister of Foreign Affairs Tomáš Petříček plans to stand for chairman of the Social Democratic Party at its Congress in April. He told the news site Seznam Spravy that he aimed to change the party's leadership style. After a rather poor showing in the Senate and regional elections last October, Minister Petříček had said that he would not run for the top post. Current party leader Jan Hamáček said he was not surprised by the move and will announce his own intentions in good time. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs will provide some 300,000 crowns to help ethnic Czechs living in Croatia, which was hit by a 6.2 magnitude earthquake in December 2020. The Czech government earlier sent some 5 million crowns worth of equipment to Croatia, including tents and sleeping bags. Motorists looking to cross into Germany at Rozvadov in the Tachov region are again facing hours of delay due to the need to produce negative COVID-19 test results. As of noon on Tuesday, the queue of mainly lorry drivers with foreign plates stretched some 10 to 12 kilometers long. Germany closed its border with the Czech Republic on Sunday after designating the country as a very high-risk one, due to the growing number of variant coronavirus cases on Czech territory. And finally, the weather. Wednesday should be cloudy but warm, with rain in lower climes and snow or freezing rain in the mountains. Average daytime highs are expected to range from 4 to 8 degrees Celsius. I'm Brian Kennedy, and that's the Czech news for now.
Hello and welcome to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. Coming up in today's programme, the government is ready to make concessions on pandemic strategy after it lost crucial support in the lower house. We check out a new app that provides opportunities for sledders to help the homeless, and later we'll take an in-depth look at Antonín Dvořák's New World Symphony, an American anthem that delighted and divided a nation. All that is coming up, so please stay with us. Talks started on Tuesday between the government and opposition on a revision of the pandemic measures in place and a gradual easing of restrictions as soon as the situation allows. The negotiations were triggered by the need to reach an agreement after the ruling coalition lost the support of the Communist Party and is no longer able to push through its own pandemic strategy in the lower house. Daniela Lazarova has the story.
The British mutation of the virus, which has been driving up COVID numbers in the Czech Republic, is not the only complication the Babish government is facing in the fight against the epidemic. The sudden loss of support from the Communist Party, which has been crucial to pushing through its strategy in the lower house, left it powerless to extend the state of emergency on which all the measures in place hinge. At the 11th hour, it was given a fortnight's grace by the country's regional governors, thanks to whom it was able to call a new state of emergency until February 28th. In the course of that time, it will have to win support in the lower house for a new legal framework within which it can continue to enforce restrictions without a state of emergency, or persuade the opposition to extend the state of emergency once again after meeting its demand to revise the measures and get rid of the restrictions that are not working. On Monday, the government took several steps towards fulfilling those goals. It passed a bill on pandemics, which would enable the Health Ministry to impose almost all of the coronavirus restrictions now in place, with the exception of restricting freedom of movement. The hitch is that the respective bill is almost identical with that which the government presented to the lower house last summer, and which was rejected as ill-conceived. The opposition parties say it would require numerous amendments in order to win approval, which is not likely to happen in the space of a fortnight. Prime Minister Andrej Babiš himself noted on Sunday that he did not expect this to happen and was counting on reaching agreement with the opposition regarding the measures in place. And the announcements made on Monday indicate that this is the strategy that the government is banking on. Following talks with regional governors, Trade and Industry Minister Karel Havlíček announced that he would propose to the cabinet the reopening of shops as of Monday, February the 22nd. The government's Council for Health Matters on Tuesday endorsed the idea. Another big demand is for schools to reopen as soon as possible, and Education Minister Robert Plaga said on Monday that more primary school children and students in their last year could return to the classroom as of March 1st, with non-invasive tests and the recommended safety precautions. Speeding up the process of vaccinations is another demand on the table. Just how much will change in the course of the next fortnight is not clear. What is that the ruling coalition has been made to understand that it is no longer in a position to call the shots alone.
And that was Daniela Lazarová with that report. Now, on a lighter note, in recent days, simple pink sleds have been grabbing attention in parks in Prague and elsewhere in the country. The snow gliders are chained up but can be accessed via a mobile app created by the bike sharing organisation Rekola. Part of the largely symbolic fee goes to help the homeless. And Ian Willoughby discussed the scheme with Rekola's Jan Střecha.
We had this thing in 2017 and I knew that we have those sleds in our workshop just laying around. So I was just waiting for winter to come and to put them in use in Prague and in other cities. And then the winter came, so I was like, yeah, let's do it. So we did like a really quick action. We were able to, in like 3 days, get all the sleds and all the IT stuff ready to let people enjoy those sleds on hills in Czech Republic.
Well, I've never even heard of the idea of a rental of sleds or ski gliders via an app. What has been their response so far?
The response has been great. I think everyone loved it because due to current situation, everyone's kind of depressed at home. Even Mr. Hip from Prague, the governor, he said it's okay to go outside and enjoy the sleds because, yeah, everyone's just, I don't want to say depressed, but everyone's kind of feeling sad and lonely when he's at home. And now when we can enjoy winter and for a short period of time, just forget about what's going on. Everyone's been loving it.
I'm kind of surprised that people are renting the sleds because I thought every Czech owned one already.
Well, usually when you have kids, you do, but usually then they get like stuck in the basement or something, or they break or anything. And especially right now with the shops closed, they went sold out on the internet and you can buy them in normal shops. So we were happy that we had some in our workshop. So we just said, okay, let's use it. Because for example, in Prague, you have snow like every 4 or 5 years. And we think it's really useless to buy a piece of plastic that you're just going to have to stick somewhere around your house and then don't use it for this period for like 4 or 5 years. We thought about it as kind of like a sustainable option to instead of buying plastic slats.
This project isn't only here in Prague.
Yes, it's in all cities that we are in as Rekola Bike Sharing. We are in Prague, Brno, Olomouc and České Budějovice. And there's around, I think, 50 sleds altogether.
And I understand also there is a charity aspect to this project with some of the money going to the Salvation Army.
Yes, you're correct. Because, you know, when we were thinking about it, lots of people in Prague enjoy snow and freezing temperatures and so on. But for some people, it's not a good time of a year. So we connected with the Salvation Army and they have a project called Nosleženka, which is about donating money that goes straight away to funding homeless people's shelters throughout winter. So we are happy that our users have been donating so far quite a lot of money. I don't have the exact amount right now, but we're going to see. So it's really good that people can enjoy the outside and also think about that not for everyone winter's great time of the year.
Well, this winter may be close to the end. At least the very, very cold temperatures may be ending. The project seems to have been a big success. Would you like to do it again in the future?
I would love to do it again in the future. We'll see if there's snow. We will still have our sleds laying around. So we'll again make them available for sharing for people, because as we see, people are really enjoying it and they like the thing that they don't have to buy themselves their own sleds.
And that was Jan Stricha from the company Rekola speaking to Ian Willoughby there. Just a reminder that you're listening to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. Well, it's now time for our main feature of the day, where we look at Antonín Dvořák's New World Symphony with Brian Kennedy.
Antonín Dvořák enjoyed near universal popularity in the United States by the time he arrived in New York City in September 1892 to lead the National Conservatory of Music. The conservatory's founder had great hopes that his stewardship would elevate the institution to rival those of Europe, while others believed he could help the country's classical music culture develop its own voice. Dvořák came to believe that so-called Negro melodies should form the basis for a distinctly American classical style. He was not the first to say so, but the Czech composer's outsized stature and outsider status reignited widespread debate about the nature and future of American composition and exposed racism within the classical musical world. So says musicologist Douglas Shadle, whose latest book traces the 1893 premiere of Dvořák's most famous piece from his American sojourn. Antonín Dvořák's Symphony No. 9 in E minor, subtitled From the New World, is among the universally most beloved and widely performed pieces of classical music today. It also is, just as it was in the 19th century, his most controversial work and still somewhat shrouded in historical myth. Dvořák's assertion in a May 1893 interview for the New York Herald about the potential role of black vernacular music, quote, launched a months-long debate riddled with racist invective that put the white racial foundation of American classical music on full display, Professor Shadle writes in his new book, Antonín Dvořák's New World Symphony.
To make a long story short, there was a very ambitious philanthropist named Jeanette Thurber, who was very invested in developing an American operatic tradition in the 1880s. And this conservatory had some ups and downs over its first few years, including some turnover at the director position. And she soon realized that opera being what it is, opera is going to be dramatic, that maybe having an executive director who wasn't so invested in opera might be a good idea. But her faculty eventually advised her to pursue Dvorak, who at the time was one of the most famous composers, both in Central Europe as well as in the United Kingdom. So had a very strong following among Czech and German musicians, as well as English-speaking musicians. And as I outlined in the book, too, his music was also very popular in the United States throughout the 1880s. And so there was a lot of incentive to bring in someone with this level of authority within the musical world to New York City. She wanted her conservatory to rival the conservatories of Europe and Amsterdam, Berlin, and other German cities. And so she felt like she needed someone to do this. And so she offered him just a really exorbitant amount of money to come. It was about $15,000 in 1890s money. And then she also offered him things like time off during the summer to compose, and he would be teaching the best composition students. And so he was very attracted to this position.
The famous Czech composer was invited to lead the National Conservatory of Music by a philanthropist of socially progressive causes named Jeanette Thurber, with whom he would come to advocate providing free education there for exceptional black musicians. Dvorak could not have imagined that his tenure as conservatory director between the years 1892 and 1895 would so reflect America's broader racial divides at the dawn of the Jim Crow era, period marked by lynching, disenfranchisement, segregation, and the conquest of Native American lands.
And part of the story that is, I think, somewhat misunderstood is that early on, he was not enticed by the prospect of developing a specifically American musical style. It was simply to run this conservatory. But as I show in the book, the idea of developing an American musical style was one of the most significant topics within United States discourse and musical press and among musicians. And so as he was planning his trip over and during his trip and shortly after his arrival, he quickly understood that he would be asked to weigh in on these issues, given that it was already a hot button topic and had been for several years, if not a decade or more. And so by the time he arrived, he learned that the stakes of his directorship of the conservatory were quite a bit higher than just leading the conservatory, and that he might have an impact on musical life more broadly through compositional channels. And so in May of 1893, which is just about 8 months after he arrived, he famously stated that he thought that music by African-American musicians, this kind of folk music or vernacular music, should become the basis of a classical style. He was not the first person to say this by any stretch of the imagination. And in my book, I go into a sort of a long discussion of composers who had tried this and thought about it and explained why it was good. Again, for about 10 or 15 years prior to Dvorak's arrival. But I also show that that view was a minority position at the time. It was not widely accepted. And so for Dvorak to give this kind of international authoritative imprimatur to the idea really changed the nature of that discourse. And now all of a sudden it had a type of cachet that it had not had previously. And so it inflamed a lot of negative reactions from American composers, I would say by and large negative. But there was a small contingent of American musicians, and most importantly, African-American musicians who welcomed and embraced this declaration from Dvorak. And so on the one hand, he influenced American composers. But I would say that when we're talking about African-American composers and musicians, it was more he inspired them to continue down a path that they had wanted to pursue already. And so it's kind of a mutual influence and inspiration.
In May 1893, just before he planned to leave the city with his family for the summer, the New York Herald published the explosive interview that included what became known as the Dvorak Statement. "I am now satisfied," he said, "that the future music of this country must be founded upon what are called Negro melodies. This must be the real foundation of any serious and original school of composition to be developed in the United States." Dvorak's New World Symphony, which the New York Philharmonic agreed to premiere in December 1893, was supposed to prove his hypothesis, says Professor Schedel.
The sort of final side of the story that you're asking about is how did he reach this conclusion over 8 months? And in the book, I follow about 8 different channels of influence on him. So there were several individuals from different strands of his experience in New York City that brought him to this conclusion. The most important of which was one of the voice students at the conservatory named Harry T. Burley, who was a baritone vocalist, and it's probably the most well-known companion of Dvorak as far as this side of Dvorak's residency goes. But Burley sang spirituals and other vernacular music for Dvorak in his own home with his children there, and they developed a very good relationship. Michael Beckerman, a scholar at New York University, has shown that the music critic James Huneker had a profound influence on Dvorak too by showing him this article in a music magazine that appeared in 1892, written by a woman in Louisville, Kentucky, who was a school teacher but had compiled street cries of African-American residents of the city and had published these street cries along with an analysis of the music, the musical characteristics. And in that article, she mentions that maybe some musical messiah will appear who will use this music as the basis of a classical style. And so I think Dvorak starts to get all these ideas. But there are even a few other individuals. So there's an older gentleman named Colonel Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who was a Civil War veteran, who during his time in the war and shortly thereafter collected African-American folk music in the South and then published it in a widely shared essay in 1867. And Higginson incidentally gave the keynote speech at Dvorak's big arrival concert in October of 1892. There's another music critic named Henry Krehbiel, a very famous critic who wrote for the New York Tribune, who was another compiler of African-American folk melodies and became Dvorak's leading advocate during this period. And I think it's highly likely that he and Dvorak had many conversations about this topic as well. And so Dvorak was getting input from a lot of people in the United States who were invested in the preservation of African-American folk music, as well as signaling its importance for American culture and American musical culture and history in general. And so that Dvorak reached the conclusion that he reached, I think makes sense given his proclivities for using bohemian folk dance and folk melody in many of his earlier pieces, including symphonic pieces. And so I think the one of the more fun aspects of this story is really seeing the kaleidoscope of personalities beyond Dvorak who played a role in the story, both kind of feeding into Dvorak and then fanning out from his statements, his famous statements in May of 1893.
A New York Herald article published on December 17th, 1893, wrote about the premiere of Dvorak's New World Symphony as being the musical event of the year. It described a night at Carnegie Hall that ended in a thunderous storm of applause and cries of "Dvorak, Dvorak," as New York hailed the Czech composer. Setting aside historical questions for a moment, I asked musicologist Douglas Shadle, an expert on 19th century American classical music, what, in his view, makes the composition so special, so universally beloved today.
Yeah, so in the introduction to the book, I talk about my own first encounter with the New World Symphony, which is when I was about 14 years old. You know, of course, I had no idea about any of these backstories. I heard it, you know, just as a piece of music, if you will. And I think there are many musical aspects of it that are a part of this story, but don't necessarily require knowledge of the story. One is the rhythmic vitality and the energy, especially in the three faster movements. But beyond that, this music is dramatic. I think that's the best way for me to describe it. But each movement is its own sort of microdrama that creates a larger story arc from beginning to end. And it's not the story arc, say, of a Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which is from struggle to triumph. It's not a kind of story arc with leitmotifs like a Richard Wagner opera. It's a story arc that invokes a wide spectrum of emotions in a way that I think few other symphonies actually do. I mean, symphonies are all rather complex and large, and that's what makes them symphonies. They're multi-movement, this sort of thing. But the New World Symphony has a depth and a breadth of emotional expression, of dramatic expression, that really makes it stand out. And then when you add in all of these other cultural signifiers, like its engagement with African-American music and potentially Native American music and the other sort of non-musical things like the story of Hiawatha that Dvorak was thinking about, it's really, I mean, I think it's one of the most densely thought out symphonies in the literature. I'm the last person to say that a piece is great for all time, but I would just argue that I think this is the reason why many people have found it so compelling. I don't think it's necessarily inherently compelling. I'm just saying that people tend to want something with human interest and drama in it. And even though it's instrumental, I think Dvorak has found a way to reach outside purely musical expression to bring people into it. There's just so much in it to enjoy. The melodies are catchy, the rhythms, it's truly a wonderful piece.
In the second part of our discussion with Douglas Shadle, author of the book Antonín Dvořák's New World Symphony, we learn more about the specifics of the famous composition, what American influences can be found in the Czech composer's work, and trace Dvořák's influence on some of the black musicians and intellectuals who brought about the Harlem Renaissance, and who considered his advocacy of African-American spirituals a significant milestone.
And that was musicologist Douglas Shadle speaking to Brian Kennedy there in what is the first part of a two-part interview about Antonín Dvořák's New World Symphony. If you have any comments about today's programme, then please send them to us. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook and Twitter. We'll certainly be glad to hear from you. But now that is all from me, Tom McEncrow. I thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.